wildlife and its habitat cannot speak. So we must. And we will.
You're listening to the Conservation Federation of Missouri podcast. Here's Executive Director Brandon Butler.
It is the day after the close of the 2017 Missouri rifle or firearms deer season, and I'm sitting down with Jason Sumners, MDC's wildlife chief. Welcome, Jason.
Happy to be here, Brandon.
So I think you're setting a new bar. My first guest under 40. Let's see if we can pull this off.
We'll do what we can, I guess.
Yeah.
Certainly not the experience that some of your previous guests have had.
We've been on the Legends Tour, and now we're starting the Future Legends Tour.
Oh, yeah, that's a high bar.
Well, you've had a great year concerning white-tailed deer in Missouri. We've had an exceptional youth season, good archery season, and the numbers coming out on firearm season are very impressive.
Yeah. So I think a few things have come together. One, weather's been really, really good. And so that trend had been pretty obvious through some of the early archery harvest and then the really high youth harvest that we saw that was considerably higher than it was last year. And then weather through much of the firearm season was pretty good. We had a couple of windy and cold days, but for the most part, it was pretty good. And then we're on the recovery point of the 2012 hemorrhagic outbreak. So I think in most places, deer populations have recovered from that. So we're slowly seeing increasing numbers in places. And so it resulted in increased harvest. So the preliminary numbers say about 191,000 deer killed during the November portion, which is up 5,000 or 6,000 from last year, which is pretty good.
Yeah, that's great to see the growth coming back after a couple of down years, as you said, the EHD outbreaks, 2012, and then subsequent year we had a little bit less, but still an outbreak, and we're seeing how quickly a herd can rebound.
Yeah, it can happen pretty fast, and one of the other things we're kind of seeing, too, is some of the impacts of the antler point restriction and then the results of having to remove the antler point restriction because of expanding CWD management zones, so buck harvest up this year, about 4,000 or 5,000. The other thing there we see is that as the date creeps earlier, so the earliest the November portion of the firearm season can open is November 10th, and the latest it can open is November 16th. But through time, what we have noticed is that as it creeps closer towards that 10th date, we tend to increase harvest and we tend to increase buck harvest.
And that's because the rut is.
And that's because, yeah, and it's amazing to think that, yeah, 4, 5, 6 days would make that much difference, but it actually does in terms of where we are with a very synchronized breeding season, with most of the breeding occurring, you know, between the 10th and the 12th of November. So we see that increase in harvest, and we also tend to see that we shoot a few more bucks. And so that kind of is reflective of the trend that's happened in the last couple of years. Also reflective of, in some cases, lower deer numbers, but also a much more balanced sex ratio to the herd that's the result of some of those long-term antler point restriction and focus on antlerless harvest, protect bucks in older age classes. So there are more bucks out there for folks to harvest. And now folks are being a little more selective in terms of shooting antlerless deer, given that numbers had been down. So we're getting the total numbers the same, but a lot of it's now being taken up by bucks, a higher proportion of antlerless deer.
It's interesting to watch social media unfold on the rut. And I read posts from people who complained that the rut was non-existent this year. And I read posts from people who were looking for body armor to keep from being run over by bucks. I think I was somewhere in the middle. I definitely experienced rutting activity, bucks chasing does in front of me. Like always, many more young bucks out in daylight hours, just out of their minds, pushing does around. But I had some really good rutting activity, both in North Missouri and Howard County, and then down south in Shannon County. How did it unfold for you this year?
Yeah, so for me, it's always a matter of, are you in the right spot where there's an estrous female at the right time? That determines whether you perceive that the rut is occurring at the appropriate time or not. And so, yeah, I had Friday before the opener, I was on the X, you know, I saw seven adult bucks and four does, and two of them were being tended by a buck. They were, you know, falling close behind. And then actually, as I was climbing out of the stand on that Friday, there was a chase occurring in the woods behind me. And so it was on, you know, and then later in the week, as the firearm season progressed, saw the bucks out cruising. They're trying to find those remaining estrous does. The peak of much of our breeding occurs between the 10th and the 12th. So that tends to be our median breeding date. So by that time, about half of the females have been bred. So after that, the bucks are then into the back end of sort of a seeking phase, trying to find those other estrus does. So my observation was it was pretty good, but certainly timing and what drives it and what drives what people see is always a hot topic around deer camp.
You know, we were talking just a few minutes ago about the evolution of deer hunting and how it's changed, and we're kind of that generation where we're growing up through major technological advancements. When we were younger, 20, 25 years ago now, hunting in a hodgepodge of clothing, and I was telling you that my original tree stands were tile pallets nailed into fork trees, and just how much it's changed in the advent of the trail cameras, and what a cool tool it is to be able to monitor activity. And my tree stand is about a mile and a half back into public land, and it's way up on a ridge with a logging road running across the crest of that ridge, and just so many scrapes on there. And then to be able to set up trail cameras along that travel corridor and see when the big boys start showing up during daylight hours. It's synchronized almost. It's not like one buck starts showing up and then another. There's just this window where the big ones are showing up on their feet. And thankfully, I was able to get a really good buck on camera, and I took him about 30 minutes into the rifle season, which allowed me to get back to work on the old cabin. But it worked out well. And there's aspects of the technology that I think might be a little bit too much, but there sure are some pretty cool opportunities to use cameras and things these days.
Yeah, well, I think if you think back, I'm not sure, short of the center fire rifle and a scope, that there's been anything that's probably changed deer hunting more than the trail camera. The ability to see what's out there, to know there are other deer out there, that the first little yearling buck that comes by or a basket rack 8.2-year-old that comes by, you know there's another deer out there that's bigger. So it's hard to, it sometimes makes you stay in the stand longer. It gives you comfort to pass things up. It allows you to develop some of those observations you described about behavioral stuff. You're talking about the scrape showing up. One of the things I don't think people had a great appreciation for is the frequency of visits that does actually make to those. Those aren't just buck scent locations. Does are going there to figure out and be selective as to what mate they choose as well. So yeah, trail cameras probably have changed the way hunters behave in a way that no other recent technological advancement has.
And I don't know if you call social media an advancement, but it's definitely having an impact on hunting.
Yeah, so, I'm not sure if it's taken us forward or not, yeah, but it's had an impact.
So my hunting buddy, Chris Brown, 14-year-old kid, famous for being on the cover of Conservation Federation magazine with his big turkey he got during the governor's youth turkey hunt. He killed a buck last year, his first deer, and now he's a trophy hunter. 14-year-old, we were on three hunts together last weekend, had 40 deer in front of this kid, and he didn't want to pull the trigger on any of them because a couple of his buddies had posted their bucks to Facebook, and you can't shoot a buck smaller than your buddy's buck, and these right. things live in a digital world now. And when we were growing up, you know, you took it to the check station and
it showed up on the front page of the newspaper, maybe.
Yeah, if you got to the newspaper, it was something special. Yep. But now it's this entire social network of sharing photos, and there's certain times a year where things happen, kids going back to school and Halloween costumes. Right now, we're in the heart of the buck pictures on my Facebook scroll, and I love it personally. I think it positively promotes hunting as long as the pictures are tasteful, and I don't want to see it breed any kind of competition, but if it elevates people to hunt for more mature deer and hunt for a deer that they're just excited to show to people, I think that's neat.
Yeah, I do too. And I also think that it's kind of that environment or that forum that now no longer existed with the absence of the check stations, right? So a young kid may take his first deer, first turkey, and would take it to a check station back 10 or 15 or more years ago and then get that, hey, congratulations, this is awesome, the pats on the back. Well, now they don't have that opportunity. And I think if used positively, yeah, the social media provides that forum where they can get some of that congratulations, that's really cool kinds of feedback, which I think is neat.
Yeah, I do too. And again, we had an incredible youth season. When we talk about numbers, over 17,000 Missouri youths were successful in the two-day youth season. We look at hunter trends across the country, and unfortunate numbers recently came out showing a pretty significant decline in hunter numbers, but here in Missouri, you guys at the department do such a good job with promotion and education that our hunter numbers continue to climb. We continue to be a leader in recruitment and retention, and to have a youth season as successful as we did, that I think is a very special feather in your guys' cap for a job well done.
Certainly appreciate that. We spend a lot of time and energy talking about how do we minimize those barriers that keep kids from participating. And there's no question the youth portions of both our deer and turkey season and our waterfowl youth portions are just extra time and extra time in the woods to pursue something that kids often don't have the opportunity to. So I think it's been good. It's helped mitigate some of the demographic changes that are leading to decline in hunter numbers. While we've been very successful, I think the cold, hard reality is that the baby boomer generation is aging. And so we've been able to overcome some of the declines that other states have seen, are seeing, but they're on the horizon. And so the future of increasing hunter numbers, or at least stable hunting numbers in Missouri, I'm a little concerned about it still, especially if we look at the way the recruitment rate of hunters into that. We're getting a lot of young hunters that will go out and they'll hunt the first time, but this huge expansion of those that are participating, they're not continuing to participate. So I think that's one of the next big gaps that we have to work out and figure out what's the deal. They don't continue to participate at the same rate that youth did when we were young, if we look back through time. So there's some real questions to that retention part. We're getting them out there. We're providing the time to get them out there the first time, but we're not necessarily attaching them and making them lifelong hunters.
You have any theories on why?
I don't know. I think there's lots and lots of questions about who's taking them. You know, one of the questions I roll around in the back of my mind, that at some level, there's a social tolerance to the number of hunters as to... We see the trends of actually corporate farms getting larger and larger, of lands being leased, of folks focusing on wanting to harvest more mature bucks. And so is there some just social carrying capacity of the number of hunters on the landscape that we're willing to accept and offer opportunities for folks to hunt as deer management things begin to be more intense?
Well, access is a...
And so, yeah, so that issue. Access question really becomes a deal. It's, you can take somebody out hunting and show them how to hunt and fish, but then where do they go?
It's interesting because we're in this public lands fight nationally right now, but it's a very Western issue as far as promotion. A lot of the groups that you hear talking about it, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, these advocacy groups that are fighting for public lands day in and day out, you're hearing about these monuments in Utah and in Montana and places, but public land is even more important in the East because there's less of it and more people. So I'm fortunate to have had the experience of living in Montana, getting this like appreciation, a Western appreciation for public lands, and then bringing that back to the Midwest and applying it. And Missouri is hands down one of the better public land states in the Midwest. Growing up in Indiana, it was just a nightmare to consider going out onto public lands, which would be smaller fish and wildlife areas, opening weekend. You could see in certain stretches where we hunted down by Winnemac, Indiana, you could see a line along the roadside where hunters were just positioned every 50 yards. And so public lands got a bad name for a long time. But here in our state, there's so much public property and it's managed so well that we really, I think, need to do a better job of positively promoting the opportunities for people to get out on public land. Because you still talk to people and it's almost like a negative connotation when they say, oh, I'm just hunting public land. Well, that public land
can be phenomenal. Tremendous opportunities. Yeah. We see public land deer and turkeys that kind of boggle your mind. There's no question a lot of pressure gets applied on our public lands. You know, less than 5% of Missouri is in public ownership. And when we talk about deer hunting, our annual surveys indicate that in the neighborhood of 10 to 12% of our deer hunters hunt only on public land. And as much as 25% of them deer hunt at some point in time during the season on public land. And so proportionally, you can see that we do apply a lot of pressure to the deer and turkey populations on public land. And so that results in us sometimes having to be more restrictive with regulations to provide some better hunting opportunities. But yeah, from a management standpoint, I've hunted public land in a number of other states, Kansas, Nebraska, you know, Wyoming. And yeah, the quality of management and the attempts to support good wildlife populations here is second to none.
And I think public land rules kind of transcend state lines in the sense that most of that pressure is applied to the fringes of those public properties.
Absolutely.
People are hunting close to the road. They're hunting close to parking lots. So if you're willing to just put a little boot leather to work, you get back in there a half mile or more, you can be into some really good habitat and have very little competition for that area.
Yeah, there's been some really interesting research done, especially in a place like Pennsylvania where you got pretty steep terrain and stuff. You get more than like a quarter of a mile from a road or a parking lot, and basically the deer live in a refuge. There's no hunters, the vast majority of them don't go that far. And so, there's great opportunities, no doubt.
Well, we had a great deer season, and that's good news. And thanks for all your efforts on the wildlife and what you've done. I think we forgot to mention that you did give up probably the best job in the state to become the wildlife chief. I mean, a guy who loves deer hunting as much as you, to be the former deer biologist, where you only focused on deer. Now you've got so many things under your purview. But what was it like to go from the deer biologist to the wildlife chief?
That was a bit of a tough personal kind of struggle, right? You go to college, you grow up thinking that's what you want to do. You go to college, you spend many years in graduate school doing research, kind of trying to set yourself to that stage. You get the unique opportunity to come home and do it in your home state. Yeah, it was a little bit of a tough decision to give that up, but one that I don't regret at all. Being a wildlife division chief has been an amazing experience, working on a diversity of topics and moving things forward at a higher level. So it's got its own tremendous rewards. Folks ask if I missed the field, and frankly, the deer job had turned into an administratively heavy job, and so I wasn't out trapping deer and doing a lot of those things towards the end anyway. So it's been a good transition, one I'm happy I made.
Well, one of those topics that we're working on here in Missouri are elk. And I want to get to the incredible public herd that we have down in the southern part, but you never know what a day is going to bring in your job. And this year it brought a young hunter, a 14-year-old girl, killing an elk in the wild in Boone County, Missouri. Walk me through that.
Yeah, actually, I was a CWD sampling station in Warsaw, and my phone rang. Our wildlife management leader, when he calls, there's usually something going on because he's dealing with mountain lions, bears, feral hogs, and elk stuff. And so I answered the phone. Yeah, they indicated that a young hunter had taken an elk in Boone County, and we were working through the process of figuring out where it came from and what happened. So, yeah, I mean, we get these things. It's really interesting. We get critters popping up on the Missouri landscape all the time. And so most likely this is an escape captive. Not likely that it's one of our restored elk from the herd down in southeast Missouri. So, yeah, it's not unusual. It's not unusual for us to get fallow deer harvested during the firearms deer season. You know, the things like the wolf that was confused for a coyote a few years ago. Years and years ago, we had a moose wander into the state. So things pop up here in places that they don't normally belong. And folks sometimes have a hard time understanding that what they saw isn't what they thought it was.
When you talk about an escape captive, some people might not know exactly what we're talking about. There are captive populations of cervids, which are deer, elk, moose, the deer family, essentially, cervids. And those deer or elk are behind a single fence. All it takes is a tree falling down on that fence to knock it over, or other ways that fence can become compromised. And then those animals are able to escape into the wild and unfortunately could potentially bring with them any diseases that might have been in that containment area. So it's likely that this elk is an escapee to be in this part of the state. It's good that it's no longer on the landscape, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the most likely source of it. We have had, over the last several years, reports of elk in North Missouri that you start to question what the true origin of them might be. Some of those very well could be animals, especially when they're young males, could be ones that have dispersed in from herds that are growing in central Nebraska and central Kansas. But yeah, to make it that far into central Missouri, the likelihood's relatively low. But yeah, so folks have confined wildlife all across this state. And yeah, occasionally things happen that they get out, and occasionally a hunter encounters them and takes one. So they did the right thing, absolutely did the right thing, reported it to the department so that we could investigate, so we could most importantly test the animal for CWD. As you indicated, it's a potential source of introducing the disease to a place where we don't currently know that it exists.
And it really set off a social media firestorm. I don't know how many tens of thousands of views and comments were on these posts, but some of them very fortunate, some of them very unfortunate. You know, you're talking about a 14-year-old girl who saw a antlered animal in the forest, and she shot it. It was a mistake. I mean, you could argue that she should have known it wasn't a white-tailed deer, but for any of us that have hunted a long time, you know what that adrenaline is like. She identified an antlered target, and she shot it. Her dad immediately recognized that it was an elk and called the department, did the right thing. So I'm proud of the way that this girl handled herself. I saw her on social media trying to fight back against some of the folks that might have been saying things that weren't specifically nice to her. It's just unfortunate when people take shots at somebody that young and that enthusiastic about the outdoors. So if this ever gets back to that family, I just, you know, you've got my support in what you did and how you did it. Hopefully it's a mistake that won't be made again, but it was a simple mistake, and good job on calling the department and turning it in.
Yeah, I think it's a teachable moment on so many levels. We get ingrained in hunter education to be sure and understanding of what your target is, to be safe and careful, that when something happened, they were willing to report it. They were honest about the mistake. And we have that happen with the antler point restriction. Folks, for all right and intentions, think they're shooting a doe and they shoot a small spike, you know, do the right thing and report it. And in most situations, the conservation agent are going to use common sense and make a good decision. The other teachable moment for us as an agency is that we now have a free-ranging elk herd in the eastern Ozarks around Peck Ranch and in Carter and Shannon counties. And so we need to start educating our hunters as to what they might encounter out there on the Missouri landscape, so that this mistaken identity of an animal isn't one of our elk that we're trying to grow.
In my experience in talking to a number of hunters down in Eminence, during a weekend when a managed hunt was going on in the wildlife refuge on Peck Ranch, they were having elk come by them in their tree stands.
Yeah, absolutely.
So most people that are in that area are aware that these animals are also on the landscape and know the difference. And thankfully, we haven't had that incident yet, and hopefully we never will. But it was really neat listening to these bow hunters that are like, this elk just wouldn't stop bugling by me, screwing up my deer hunt.
What a problem to have.
But I was fortunate recently to go down. Aaron Jeffries from the department and myself and a number of legislators toured Peck Ranch, and we were able to show these elected officials some incredible animals. The bulls are really coming into their own.
They're beautiful, right? So yeah, they're hitting that 5 and 6 year old, where their whitetail at 3 years old, his skeleton's completely grown. And so then after 3, he can start investing resources in growing antlers. Well, with an elk, you're talking 4 and 5 and maybe 6 years old before the skeleton's completely grown. And then they can start investing all those excess resources in growing antlers. So those first couple groups of young bulls, whether they were 1.5 year old bulls or bull calves that we moved, are now maturing into those older age classes, and in a place where we got really good forage. The habitat management work that we've done on Peck Ranch, that we've done in partnership with the Park Service, was providing them really, really good year-round high-quality nutrition, so they're now being able to exhibit that, and it's pretty darn impressive.
It really is, and when you're in Missouri and you're hearing a wild elk bugle and watching a bull push a harem of cows across the field, it's a pretty magical experience, and one that I've written about extensively and hopefully sent a number of people down to experience for themselves. And in talking to local businesses in Eminence, Ellington, Van Buren area, there is a fight going on over who is the elk capital of Missouri. And I think it's really neat to see that sometimes decisions are made that initially can be somewhat contentious. There's people that are for it, there's people that are against it, and typically they're operating on emotion and an opinion. And now, just a few years later, you've got communities that have embraced these animals because they're seeing a direct economic impact. And we haven't even scratched the surface of the potential of that impact yet because we don't have a hunt. Now it's just tourists that are extending vacation season in the Ozarks at least another month.
Absolutely.
You talk to Jim Anderson, the mayor of Eminence, also the owner of Shady Lane Cabins, and he's got cabins booked in a month where he was typically shutting everything down. So it's been a great addition to our landscape, bringing these animals back. That's another important fact, is that these animals belong here. They're a native species. They're just being returned. We're righting a wrong. But it's not only important for wildlife, it's important for those communities.
Yeah, it is. It's very important for those communities that are recreation is a critical part of what allows them to continue to survive. And outside of the warm months when you can float down the river, activity there certainly slows down. And so those businesses are, like you alluded, are recognizing and very appreciative of having the elk there. And yeah, it's been one that's been very successful. We've not had issues with them getting into places that they shouldn't be. Part of that's because of the active management the department's been doing, trying to make sure that they stay on public land. That's why we chose that area as an area dominated by public land where we can manage them and try to minimize conflicts. But certainly as the herd grows and more elk, we're starting to see it. The herd's growing, so they're starting to push off into other areas and expand a little bit. And the likelihood of them getting into some places and causing some conflict is real. But I think the important part is that folks are embracing them and they taking great ownership and pride in having them on the landscape down there. So it's been, to this point, a really successful project.
So what can we do to move them northwest a little ways into the Roger Pryor backcountry? You know, I wouldn't mind sitting on my porch listening to a bull scream one day.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're gonna see what the elk tell us they want to do. Where do they find places where they feel comfortable and make those decisions in terms of what's the public willing to accept and where will the elk be successful?
So the big question, of course, though, is when will we start hunting these animals?
So the initial guidelines really were to have a minimum of 200 elk, to be showing in the neighborhood of 10% annual growth, and to have a pretty high bull component, which, given that we're not harvesting them at this point, that's not a challenge. So today, we'd say we probably have in the neighborhood of 140 elk on the ground. The last year or so, we've been seeing 12 to 15% growth in the herd. We moved our first group of elk in 2011. We moved for 3 years, 2011, 12, and 13. And when you move a large animal like this, it's very, very stressful, them adapting to a new environment. So survival wasn't what we would expect from a restored herd, and reproductive rates and calf survival, frankly, wasn't real high, but that was to be expected. I mean, these are big animals and they can take a lot, but moving a large critter across the landscape and dumping it out someplace else is pretty darn stressful. So all of those animals have really gotten through that period. And then in the last 2 years, we've seen real, really good increases in adult survival, pregnancy rates. Pregnancy rates are really, really high. And so last year we had 40 or 50 calves on the ground. So I think in the next couple of years, the numbers should really start to bounce up. And so we'll be beginning to have that conversation of what does the first elk hunting season in Missouri look like within the next couple of years, I would guess.
I think we should start that conversation now. So here's my two cents.
Everybody has an opinion.
Yeah, but I've got you cornered.
They want to figure out how they can anywhere. Game the system. So
no, I don't want to game the system. I want the system to work best for everybody involved. And I really like the way Kentucky does it. I like the opportunity to apply. I donate my $40 a year. I mean, I think it's $10 per application. There's four different ways you can apply. Yeah. I know everybody has opinions on residents only, non-residents, but I just like the big picture opportunity. Right. Put everybody in. We're raising money for conservation. When you don't draw, you can feel good about that $10 lottery ticket. They divide it between archery and firearms. They have bull and they have cow. So I really think Kentucky's done a great job. I'm curious to know if you know how Kentucky initially started, when they were having this conversation 20 years ago, was their wildlife chief saying we're trying to get to 500 elk, or are they trying to get to the 10,000-ish that they have today?
Yeah, so they had a very, very ambitious goal. They were trying to restore a significant population to the eastern portion of Kentucky. You know, to the point where they were releasing truckloads of elk. I think they released in the neighborhood of 1,200 to 1,500 elk. So they were trying to be very aggressive in establishing a large population.
It worked.
And it worked. Yeah, it really did. And it's grown substantially.
Is 10,000 about the right number?
They're trying to figure out what the exact number is. That's the number they throw out at this point. But yeah, so they're in the neighborhood of 800 to 1,000 permits issued on an annual basis. It's pretty big, so it's a little bit of a different scenario than what we're dealing with. But yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the approach for everyone to have the opportunity to participate is one that we've talked about a lot.
So I've heard that said a few times before, that it's a different scenario than what we're dealing with. But why? I mean, isn't that a very similar habitat? And as far as the amount of public land available, it's also somewhat similar, right?
Yeah, I think it's just the quantity that's different in terms of the way they're distributed across the landscape. Yeah, I would guess, too, though, a lot of their elk occur on, it's public land, but it's also land that's leased for access. It's coal mine country. Right. And so there's large, large tracts of land that are on coal mines. Sometimes access is a little bit limiting. So they don't have sort of the private landowner concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have a lot of private landowners. We got a few that have been huge cooperators and actually have elk hanging out on them. And so that's part of the conversation we're having, too, is there a difference between how we might approach hunting elk on public land compared to how we might approach hunting elk on private land. I think just trying at this point not to close any doors in that realm of opportunities. We've sent staff to, obviously we were heavily engaged in Kentucky, we were doing the restoration, but we sent staff down to Arkansas to participate in their hunts and have some understanding of the way they've done that. So looking at all the range of options that are available to us.
Is shed hunting legal for the elk sheds across Peck Ranch?
Yeah, shed hunting is not a restricted activity in Missouri. The only place where you'll have issues with collection of sheds would be on National Park Service lands, where collecting of artifacts or anything like that's just restricted. But no, we don't have any restrictions on Department of Conservation Area lands.
Even in the refuge?
As long as you're allowed to be in the refuge at that given time, yep.
That'll be an interesting opportunity to go down there and try to find
some. Yeah, so a few folks have. Yeah, a few folks have been down there looking around and found some.
Well, that's great. It's an incredible story. And for anybody that's thought about going down and trying to see him but hasn't made the trip yet, I just really encourage you to do so. It's a success story that you can witness at the very infancy of it. And years from now, when our kids and grandkids are roaming the hills and hollers of Missouri, elk will just be a regular thing.
Yeah, it's one that for me personally is probably a career highlight. I mean, Lonnie Hansen and I and Scott McWilliams escorted the first load of elk back to Missouri, and I was actually the one lucky enough to crawl inside the trailer and run the first group of young bulls out onto the Missouri soil. So that has a bit of personal memory. And yeah, so I can't wait. I've told folks I can't wait to take my wife and son to Peck Ranch and have the opportunity to share that story with them too. And then, yeah, seeing them for the first time, we took a float trip. We'd spent a bunch of time working on the elk. And a couple of years later, we took a float trip on the Current River and ran the boat up on the gravel bar. And literally, as we stepped out, saw hoof tracks where they cross the Current River, you know. So it's those kinds of things that yeah, like you said, in the infancy of a restoration, when we hearken back to the folks talked about seeing their first deer track.
That's what I was just going to say.
We're seeing their first buck. That's where we are.
We're doing the restoration now.
It's
60 years from now.
Hearing your first bugle, hearing your first cow call, you know. So it's those kinds of things that are just really, really cool.
No, I've heard it said many times recently that we're really in the good old days of wildlife right now. Take out of the equation everything pre-1800 when wildlife was everywhere. But, yeah. I mean, we are doing a good job as a nation of managing these game species and righting a bunch of wrongs that were made a century or a century and a half ago.
Yeah, Roosevelt and Leopold would be proud, I think.
I think so, too.
In terms of the vision they had for what, especially Roosevelt, for species that we want to hunt. We think about the Wildlife Restoration Act, Pittman-Robertson, and what that was all intended to do, the creation of the Boone and Crockett Club and those organizations. Yeah, I think he'd be proud.
Oh, but what I would give to see Roosevelt march up the stairs of Congress today and slam that big stick on Rob Bishop's desk. Guys that are out west trying to destroy this public land ethic we have. I just simply can't understand it. The short-sightedness of trying to sell off our American heritage of these public lands. And I think we need to do a Teddy hologram or something, you know, if they could do that. But man, people always ask those crazy questions, you know, if you could just meet one person in history, there's no question for me, it's Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, he's top of my list too. No doubt an amazing visionary and a man who put into place some things that his conservation legacy is probably far understated.
Have you ever been out to Medora, North Dakota, and seen his ranch?
Yes. Yeah. It. I don't know. It just gives you kind of chills and goosebumps to trek across country that somebody that you think so highly of and the legacy that they have to set foot on the lands that they had a big part of conserving.
A couple great conservationists here in Missouri, Bruce and Jan Sassman, had what they called the Holy Trinity of conservation last year with John Muir, Aldo Leopold, and Henry David Thoreau. And this year, they're doing a similar event, but it's going to be Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir, who were friends, and with Roosevelt being a huge hunter and Muir being a borderline anti-hunter, I guess. Both, of course, care deeply about landscapes. But I'm excited to see this play work out. And the guy that's coming in to play Roosevelt, I mean, he's world-renowned. He's put on presentations in the White House, So keep your eye out for that. I don't know what the name of it's going to be yet, but the Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir play that the Sassmans are going to put on, it's going to be super neat.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting. Unfortunately, I had other commitments and wasn't able to make it out to the Trinity of Conservation, but man, the comments and from folks who were there were quite impressed, and so I would expect this would be the same.
It was cool. It was really cool. Boy, we've talked about a lot of great stuff. Unfortunately, there's some things going on in the state, too, that aren't such good news. And of course, one of those that every hunter at this point is probably aware of is chronic wasting disease. And I'll say that as far as awareness is concerned, that is a good thing. I mean, we've been having this conversation, you and I, now since we met 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah. And I would say that the pool of people who know what we're talking about has grown significantly. And the naysayers, the folks who say this isn't a serious disease, they've just about been stamped out at this point. Everybody knows how serious chronic wasting disease is, but you have been right in the heart of the mix. So from your perspective, what are we looking at?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those that has the unfortunate potential to completely unravel all of that we were just talking about. This tremendous whitetail deer resource and even elk resource and the mule deer resource across the western part of the country that so much of the backbone of conservation is supported by hunters and anglers and the dollars and the investment and private landowner investment in doing quality habitat management that benefits all wildlife species. And so you try not to be too doom and gloom on the topic, because that's pretty easy to get there given the severity and the consequences of the disease. But it's one that we as a state from the beginning have been very proactive in our testing, trying to understand the distribution of the disease, and also tried to be very proactive where we found it, you know, with the critical cooperation of landowners. As we started the conversation, vast majority of Missouri is in private ownership. And so as we try to battle CWD and try to keep prevalence rates as low as possible to sustain the population as long as possible, key cooperation from landowners is going to be critical. And their willingness to hang with us.
It has been critical to this point.
It absolutely has been critical for folks to give up and be willing to see what the future is. And
maybe those people haven't been thanked enough. So we could take this opportunity right now to do that and say thank you to those landowners who have watched hopes and dreams impacted. So imagine you're a guy or a gal or a family who's dreamed your whole life of of owning property to deer hunt and to manage properly. And all of a sudden this happens and the Department of Conservation comes to you and says, in order to preserve this resource for future generations, we have to really impact this population now. And we're going to have to kill a bunch of these deer that you've been dreaming of your whole life. And that landowner voluntarily says, okay. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to everybody involved. But they're doing that right thing to impact a much bigger picture than themselves. So if you know those people that have been in that situation, have empathy for them. Be thankful that they made that decision to do the right thing for all of us.
Yeah, it is. It's a tremendous sacrifice. You know, when we first found our first free-ranging CWD positive in Macon County, it's all private land. And so it is that conversation of the reality is those deer that have the disease are going to transmit it to those deer that they interact with. And so that very localized, very intense attempt to remove all the potentially CWD positive deer off the landscape is going to impact that local population. And so, yeah, those folks' willingness to, you know, we started in 2012. And so 5 years later to still be hanging with us and still be willing to remove deer themselves or allow department staff to remove deer. The other side of it has been very successful. Prevalence rates, number of positives that we've had in that core area in Macon County have remained very stable or in some cases slowly declining. In Adair County, in our core area there, the number of positives have been declining. And that's not just because there are fewer deer, but I think that's because there are fewer positives on the landscape because we've imposed some pretty intensive removals there. But it's all very localized. It's within 1 or 2 square miles of where a positive has been found. We're not shooting deer across the 730 square miles that is Macon County. We're shooting them and giving landowners additional opportunity to take animals in a 30 square mile area. And so it's that ultimate sacrifice to try to protect this valuable resource for the rest of the Missourians, you know, and how do you ask somebody who's invested their life savings potentially in buying some recreational property and then they find CWD on it. And so all of us kind of go through that struggle of asking that question, what would you do? And you just hope that folks recognize the significance of what doing that means. And like you said, show appreciation for those who have made that sacrifice to protect the deer herd that so many of us appreciate hunting.
I physically feel different right now than I felt 5 minutes ago. Like I can feel I feel tense right now. This has been so close to home for so long. Like just starting to talk about it, I can feel my blood like warming up inside of me because there's so much to be lost. There's so much invested in this resource and making sure we propel it into the future. And there's people out there that are still just blatantly spreading lies about this. And in fact, Ray I, the great turkey hunter, sent me a snapshot of a guy on Facebook promoting the fact that CWD is a scam. And I think Ray thought I was going to communicate back to this guy. And I just no longer have time for those people. Like if you're that blatantly disregarding fact and science, then you can't argue with the trolls anymore. But thankfully, I feel like the general populace is becoming more and more engaged and more informed as media starts really picking this up. I mean, we're seeing this in the newspapers now, not just Deer and Deer Hunting Magazine. It's on the news. It's in radio shows. So it's really gaining a widespread foothold as far as knowledge is concerned. And that's a good thing, I believe, because these folks that are, you know, even some of the paid guns, some of the pro high fence hunters who are out there saying CWD is a scam and so on and so forth, they're just starting to really be quieted.
Yeah, I think we've kind of reached part of it's a critical mass of the disease being distributed in more parts of the country now, asking the questions of how did it get there. But part of it's also that we now have the peer-reviewed scientific data from places like Wyoming, Colorado, that shows without question chronic wasting disease is increasing mortality, decreasing population growth, and leading to significant population declines. And so to stick our heads in the sand and say, well, it'll go away, or hemorrhagic disease is a more serious disease, it's just simply no longer true. So, yeah, I'm encouraged that the conversation is starting to change. You know, we had mandatory sampling. We started out talking a little bit about that on opening weekend. You know, staff, more than 700 of our staff deployed across the state, collecting deer, and I was over in Warsaw, you know, in Benton County, where I grew up, in a new place where CWD hadn't existed before. And when we previously found CWD, it had been a huge learning curve. It's like starting from ground zero every time we found a new place and starting to build that understanding. And so I was in Macon County when we first found it, and having those conversations, very basic conversations, building understanding. But then to be in Warsaw a couple weekends ago, and the level of understanding and the level of concern that folks had caught me as a little different. That, yeah, that awareness is really starting to grow, and it's not as new to as many folks, because they recognize that it's been popping up in other places. It may pop up in your backyard soon. So,
well, yeah, one very unfortunate place that just popped up is in the state of Montana. We look at these maps, and you often think to yourself, how is it in Wyoming, but it's not across the border in Montana? And earlier you said to me that it just hasn't been found yet, and unfortunately they found it.
Yeah, so it slowly spreads. It spreads slowly. And so, you know, the challenge is detecting a low prevalence disease really early at a time when you can do something about it. And so as it slowly spreads, it's really hard to find that one or two or five deer that were the first ones to become infected. The first one you detect is certainly not the first deer that was infected. So it's really challenging to do enough testing, to do enough surveillance, to be on top of the disease, to detect it in an early enough state where when we go in, we have the opportunity to do some intensive management that will limit prevalence. And that's really the backbone of our mandatory sampling, is to try to collect as many samples as possible, to try to detect that next new spark, to try to figure out what the distribution of the disease is using hunter-harvested animals. That way we don't have to spend time during the winter removing and testing animals, because the time of introduction of the disease when it first got there and the time of us detecting it is the critical time frame that tells us whether we're going to be able to get on top of it in that local geography or not.
And the spread of the disease is just a whole nother topic. But unfortunately, it seems often that the captive industry makes it a us against them issue. And really, we're all in this together, no matter who you are,
yeah,
what
absolutely.
Your relation to deer is. A couple points, though, of reference. It's illegal for me to bring a hunter-harvested deer into Missouri from a CWD zone. But you could still bring a live deer in from out of state. Is that true?
Correct.
And that's unfortunate. That has to be changed. And that's what we're working on in regulations now that, of course, have been impeded by the judicial system. But it looks like we'll hopefully be coming to a close on that soon. And nobody has ever said that this disease doesn't spread in the wild naturally. We know that it spreads in the wild naturally. The issue at hand, though, is when you take wildlife and put it in a trailer and move it around the country, everything that animal has goes with it. And if you look at modeling, if you look at different slides that can show you the transportation of these animals and how and where the disease has popped up, there's undoubtedly a correlation to the transportation of captive animals to the spread of this across the continent.
Yeah, it's no question. The disease moves as the deer move, whether they're dead or alive.
And whether they're in the wild or in captivity.
And so what we've tried to do is think holistic about this and what are the sources of risk. We were talking, you mentioned the Montana positive. One of those positive deer was transported by a hunter into Oregon.
That's
so the dead deer was transported into Oregon. So that's a way a hunter could unknowingly or unintentionally introduce the disease. And the same thing happens with a live animal in the back of a trailer.
And how that happens, for anybody that may not know, is the disease is in the central nervous system.
Correct.
So when you're taking parts of a harvested deer and you're putting them onto the landscape, you know, the prions can transfer from that carcass into the soil, which then can be uptaken by a live deer.
Yeah, environmental contamination. These prions are such a unique, they're just a misshapen protein. They don't break down in the environment. And so, yeah, that carcass could contain prions. And if improperly disposed of, if just thrown out on the back 40, then presents an infection risk to free-ranging cervids, whether they're deer or elk.
And one of the big issues that we continue to kind of talk around is the potential of CWD making the jump to humans. And just in the last year, we've seen really unfortunate data come out that shows it's jumped to primates, and you're starting to see recommendations from the CDC about eating potentially contaminated deer. It's impacted our Share the Harvest program. Any deer that's now harvested in a CWD-positive county, that meat has to be quarantined until the test comes back. So it's really inching towards something very scary.
Yeah, the human health risk is one that folks have always kind of been aware of or been trying to be conscious of, I guess, is probably a better way to say it. So CDC has been monitoring this situation for some time. To this point, they still say, you know, there's no known case of a human contracting the disease, although the risk is relatively low, but they're not willing to say that there is no risk. And so, yeah, like you alluded to, the Share the Harvest program there, CDC's recommendation is that you strongly encourage anyone who harvests a deer in a location that might have CWD to have it tested before consuming. So they're the human health experts, and we really try to base our recommendations and the guidance we give to hunters on that. And so that's where the Share the Harvest stuff kind of comes into, is that, you know, this meat's going to needy families, and so what can we do to minimize any risk, if there is any risk at all? You know, a hunter that harvests a deer, we have the opportunity to tell them what the risk is. These needy families many times don't know where that's coming from, and so it's a precaution that has been put into place to whatever little risk might exist there, to try to mitigate that as much as possible. And part of this is all hinged on a recent study that's being conducted in Canada and in Germany, related to macaques. They're a primate. They're the most closely related primate to humans that's been CWD tests have been conducted on it. And these animals were actually fed about a 200 milliliter ground meat from animals that weren't exhibiting clinical symptoms of CWD, but that were CWD positive, fed them a meal once a month, which would basically be the equivalent of us eating a steak once every couple weeks. And this occurred over a 2-year period. And they had a couple of those monkeys begin to exhibit symptoms of CWD and in fact showed transmission. So that study's still in process. We've still got a number of animals that are still alive that are going through that, and they hope to follow them to their final conclusion, but it's sort of elevated that concern that, again, we can't say there's no risk, and we think the risk is relatively low. We think those species-specific barriers are pretty strong, but there's some reasonable precautions that folks could or should take.
And yet, CWD is essentially the equivalent of mad cow disease in cattle, and we actually saw a mad cow jump to humans.
Right, correct. Yeah, and so that's kind of been the concern.
That's scary. I think a lot of people recognize that we're working on CWD here in Missouri, and other states are working on it. But what's the national network? How are you and your peers working across the country together, looking for big picture outcomes?
It's one of these, I guess I'd call it pretty decentralized, in terms of there are folks that are known to be working on it, but it's a relatively small group. And so the deer biologist community, the deer and elk biologist community, the CWD researchers are all pretty close-knit. You know, there's only one or two in each state, and so we pretty well know each other and meet quite frequently to talk about various issues, and CWD is always at the forefront of those conversations. So there's continual sharing of information, of things we're learning, things we're asking about. There's ask to share data. There's ask to share tissue. So there's a tremendous amount of collaboration that occurs in an attempt to tackle this common concern, regardless of whether you're in Wyoming or you're in West Virginia. Those of us that are impacted by the disease are trying to figure out what to do. And even some of the southern states that don't currently have it, they frequently call and are asking questions. What are you guys doing? What's other folks trying? If we find it, what do we do? What's worked for you? So it's a pretty close-knit, pretty small community that's trying to tackle this issue.
Hopefully there could be some more help on the way. I saw yesterday legislation was filed in the U.S. Congress for CWD funding.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
It is, when you consider the fact that Congress is always looking at ways to move money around and find money for important tasks in front of them, but now they're putting CWD on the plate as something we need to put federal dollars into, and that really ramps up
Yeah, there were a lot of federal dollars for CWD work in the early 2000s, and especially when Wisconsin first found the disease, there was a tremendous amount of support from the federal government through USDA to support surveillance work. And I think that's part of the challenge we face today is that as some of that federal money dried up, some of the states just didn't have the extra flexibility to continue to do additional testing. And so they backed off for a decade. So around, 2011, 2012 timeframe, federal funding for CWD work pretty well dried up. And so the burden fell mostly on the states. And so, yeah, there's a more recent effort to try to restore some of that.
CWD is a hard conversation to have with friends from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
They're in such a bad situation. I've seen reports and maps that show the number of positive deer in a year in a square mile. And I think the number one county had a square mile that had 47 positive deer.
They are in the exponential growth period to the point where some of those, and it's four township blocks, so 12 miles by 12 miles, 144 square mile area, in which 50% of the adult bucks have CWD. And the more concerning part is 25 to 30% of the adult females now have CWD. Here in Missouri, we know if we harvest about 20 to 25% of our adult females, the population stays stable. So you have a disease taking out 25 to 30% of the female segment of your population, it's inevitable that population declines will occur. It's just mathematically, that's what will happen. So that's the real concern, is that how do you keep the disease prevalence low enough? And then, the challenge Wisconsin's had is reduced amount of testing and stuff like that. And so, yeah, the number of unreported positives on that landscape is probably really, really high.
Well, let's try to bring the blood pressure back down.
Always a depressing topic to talk about.
This isn't a much better one either, though. Feral hogs continue to be a problem, an expanding problem in the Ozarks and across much of the southern part of the state. And I know that falls under your purview these days as well. How are you attacking the feral hog problem?
Yeah, so I guess the feral hog problem is one that we can be pretty optimistic about. There's no question that it's a significant challenge before us, but feral hog populations have been slowly increasing, especially across the eastern part of the Ozarks, but we've got populations in west central Missouri, south central Missouri. And so a very strong partnership has been developed between us, USDA Wildlife Services, DNR, Park Service, Forest Service, Department of Agriculture, Army Corps of Engineers, Fort Leonard Wood. We've been able to rally a group of partners that's quite significant on a federal scale, on the national scale, to the point where it's beginning to be recognized that not only is Missouri the model for conservation, we may be the model for how you attempt to eradicate feral hogs
and
eliminate
the
them from Missouri. And so it's not a small effort. And recently, we put together an elimination plan as a multi-partner plan. Took that to the Conservation Commission this last spring, and they were gracious enough to say, yeah, this is a significant resource issue. We're going to commit $1.8 million this year to fund a lot of additional feral hog work. And so, yeah, it's been kind of a model partnership of how state entities, whether state and federal entities, work together on a common problem.
Tell people why it's so important to get these hogs off our landscape.
Feral hogs are non-native species, and they destroy, I think the national estimate is they do about $1.5 billion worth of damage. A lot of that damage is recorded as to agricultural lands, but they have significant impacts on our natural communities, especially in the Ozarks. We have these really unique habitat types called fens, small water seeps that are very, very unique, have tremendous biological diversity. Hogs like to wallow where there's water and a little bit of mud. They have significant impacts to them. They have significant impacts to our native wildlife, whether it's competing for resources with deer and turkeys, or actually probably predating upon turkey nests and other ground nesting birds. So there's really no redeeming qualities to having feral hogs on the Missouri landscape. And I think Missouri landowners are beginning to recognize that, especially those that have had them for a number of years. And their level of tolerance of continuing to have hogs on the landscape has grown to the point where, yeah, they're now supportive of us and others trying to actively remove them.
Down by my place, there's a spring-fed creek that runs through Holler way back in the forest on public land. And when you walk down into it, it's like coming down into a scene in a Disney movie. I mean, it's just incredibly beautiful and game-rich. And then unfortunately, you'll come to portions of it that look like somebody came through with a bulldozer, and just the hog rooting is absolutely
devastating. It's amazing the amount of destruction they can do.
It's horrible.
And in that landscape, yeah, then they're increasing siltation. I mean, we treasure and value the quality of our Ozark streams, the crystal clear water, the smallmouth fishing, the floating opportunities, and you add siltation and erosion to that equation, and that's not where we want to be.
So I got kind of a tough question for you that I truly don't know the answer to. And I saw a number of Facebook posts about this from people down in the Eminence area. I guess I need to preface it with the rules and regulations. So now it is illegal to hunt feral hogs on conservation areas. And that's because you're trying to concentrate these hogs into trap sites and really remove the entire sounder at once. However, there's signs up now, and I've seen some of these signs quickly turned into targets, and they say, report, don't shoot. So my question is what if somebody shoots a feral hog while they're deer hunting or squirrel hunting? I mean, it's kind of a gray area, right? Because you want these hogs killed, people aren't allowed to hunt them, but if one just happens to come by, you got to let it go.
If you're on Department of Conservation lands, yes, we would prefer you report it to us. So feral hogs are extremely intelligent animals and become very wary when pressured. And so removing one animal at a time does nothing to eliminate the population. And that's a key distinction that folks have a hard time getting over. When we talk about management of wildlife, we manage white-tailed deer through hunting. And the amount of hunting and pressure we apply, we don't want to manage feral hogs. We want to eliminate feral hogs. And history and repeated stuff in numerous states, and in fact, in numerous countries. I was recently at the Wildlife Society meeting, and they have the same conundrum in Italy with native boars and introduced boars and the challenge of hunting. And the challenge with the allowance of hunting is that it incentivizes folks to have hogs on the landscape and that they want to continue to pursue them. And so the incentive to illegally release them is high enough because they desire the opportunity. So you remove that incentive or make hunting even legal, you know, the legal hunting or taking of them removes a little bit of that incentive. And so our approach is, and the best strategy is, to try to trap the entire group. And so when you introduce hunting into that equation, it makes it a lot more difficult. So we're having some successes, no doubt, of reducing populations and reducing numbers. And the efficiency of the trapping efforts has gone up tremendously with staff spending time on the ground learning how to do it.
Yeah, I've had a couple opportunities to go out with USDA Wildlife Services. Once trapping, we got 9 in a trap one morning and eliminated all of those. And then just a month or so ago, we went out shooting at night. And there's so much forage during the fall that it's hard to concentrate these hogs in the
traps.
Yeah,
they're acorn eaters.
They're acorn eaters, but they're also in agriculture fields, as you talked about. So I was out with a guy named Justin, and he's really made an impact around Fort Leonard Wood. He said these fields, I'll back up and say how cool this was. We had permission on private property to survey their fields at night with thermal imaging scopes. So we're driving pickup trucks, looking in fields for hogs with thermal imaging. Once you find them, the USDA guy takes them out with a suppressed 270 with a thermal imaging scope on the top. So pretty cool job out there, students, if anybody's looking for something to do after college, night sniping feral hogs out of cornfields. But he said that this field that we're looking at, just a couple of weeks ago when I came across it, there could be 50 feral hogs in this field, and we were having trouble finding them. So there's work getting done.
Right, yeah. You know, so we've got dedicated folks working for USDA that's their sole job. They wake up in the morning and go to bed at night thinking about how to kill feral hogs. And that's the way you make something successful, is you have to commit the staff time and the dollars to hire people to do that work. And you bring up the night shooting, and it always raises the question, well, you guys can do it, but you're telling us as hunters we can't. And it's very selective situations, like you describe, very certain time. We may have a situation where two pigs show up, and our ability to find them and trap them may be very limited, but one option might be to take night vision, thermal imaging, and a suppressed rifle and go out and remove them. So we still do use some of that individual shooting. But in general, hunting as a whole is not a successful way to eliminate the feral hog population.
However, on your own private land, though, you can shoot them.
Correct. Yep. Yep, you can still shoot them. That's you protecting your own property. We certainly would encourage you to report them to us. And we've got supplies. We're willing to help train folks. We've been doing a number of landowner workshops showing folks how to use traps, how to catch them.
And again, the ultimate reason why it's so important to get these off the landscape is not only the damage they physically do to the ground, but because they're out competing native species like deer and turkey. So don't think this is in any way, you know, going against hunters. This is an effort to protect hunters. This is an effort to protect the game we pursue.
Trying to protect Missouri's native wildlife.
Right.
I mean, that's really the core of the issue, and then all the other positive things that go along with it. You know, feral swine are disease replicating machines as well. They pose risk with pseudo rabies and brucellosis and a number of other things. So there's human health and agricultural livestock considerations that go into it. So it's really that true intersection of many state and federal entities' interests, and then the landowners and the ag producers of the state that all have a vested interest in feral hogs no longer existing in Missouri.
Well, Jason, you've got a job with a lot of different avenues to pursue. You're doing a great job with it, though. We appreciate the effort that you're putting in. You're following the footsteps of some great legends of the Department of Conservation, but you're also forging your own way, and I think a lot of people are taking notice. So thanks for all your efforts. And how about we go ahead and wrap this up with your overview of where we're at collectively with wildlife in Missouri today?
Well, I appreciate those comments, Brandon. It's you know, when I stepped into the job, I had the opportunity to talk to several folks who have sat in that chair, and many of them have moved on, and they said it's the best job they ever had working for MDC. And so it's been a really good one. I'm certainly humbled to sit here, and certainly gonna continue with the passion I have for protecting and doing what's right for Missouri's wildlife resources as long as we can. But I think we're in a good place. Conservation in this state is well supported. I'm encouraged to see the successes you're having with the Conservation Federation. Tremendous amount of partnerships across this state, whether it's NWTF, QDMA, Quailing Up on Wildlife, Pheasants Forever. I mean, the list of partners in St. Louis Zoo, you know, we just won a national award for restoration work on the American Bearing Beetle with the St. Louis Zoo. Revolutionary stuff, you know. And so the opportunities abound to work with citizens and communities, and the challenges are great, but the conservation legacy and commitment that the citizens of Missouri have is second to none. I mean, it's reflected in the Conservation Commission, the Soil and Water and Parks sales tax, and the commitment that citizens have. So it makes it easy to get up every morning, and I don't go to work. I go to play, you know. Challenges abound, but it's truly a passion and a calling, and so it's a good place to be.
It's a great state to be in, and it's a great time to be here.
Absolutely.